All right, welcome everybody. Tonight we're doing Parshas Re'eh, and the title is Liz Cheney, A Portrait in Courage. Okay, so I'm going to share the video momentarily, but I want to, generally I do not talk about politics. I talk about Torah, but there does come from time to time a topic which I think illustrates a certain concept in Judaism. So, and the topic of tonight is the topic of Bechira, free will. I believe the narrative around Liz Cheney, we'll get to that specifically, illustrates the beginning idea of our Parsha very well. Now, whether or not this is the real narrative, is whether this is not in Liz Cheney's hearts of hearts, obviously there's a split in a country, Democrats and Republicans. And with even within Republicans, there is a big divide. So I'm not really interested in that topic. I'm interested in utilizing the story, which we're about to share, as a way perhaps to understand the Parsha. The goal is the Parsha, the goal is not the politics. But in order to understand that, I'm gonna give you a video which sort of gives you a little bit of the political background. And I just, with a caveat, I will identify obviously that there are, this is a Trump supporter, non-Trump supporter divide. So I'm not going to get into, which one is correct. I'm not interested in that specific element. I'm interested in the story, which could be, if it is as it is portrayed, help us to understand the Parsha in a deeper way. That's our goal. All right. So I don't want to get sucked into the pit called American politics so much. So without further ado, let us go to the videotape.
The legacy of Liz Cheney is going to be about courage.
I will do everything I can to ensure the former president never again gets anywhere near the Oval Office.
In 2001, when Dick Cheney has become the vice president for George W. Bush, Liz Cheney gets hired into the State Department. At the end of the Bush-Cheney administration, Liz became a frequent guest on Fox News and spent a good 6 years or so as just this acid-tongued critic of the Obama-Biden administration.
I think what it goes to also, Sean, is the arrogance of this administration, the arrogance of this president. You know, it doesn't seem to matter to him if the people who work for him lie. The best you can say about him is that he's unacquainted with the truth.
In 2016, Liz decided to run for the House, and she basically, embraced what was the celebrity idea of, I'm a Cheney, I know Washington, I can get stuff done. And here's Liz Cheney just 2 years into the House becoming the number three Republican leader. Her father, he did hold the same exact position, but it took him 6 years to get there. And that was considered lightning fast. It really showed you her ambition and her drive and what she wanted to do. Everybody figured then, this is a woman who wants to become probably the first female House Republican speaker. She was a loyal Republican, was helping raise money for Trump reelect. She was on the team, so to speak.
This president has shown that he is willing consistently to walk away from bad deals. He walked away from the nuclear deal with Iran. He walked away from the INF treaty. This is a president who has demonstrated his willingness and his ability and his determination not to let the United States be taken advantage of.
During the Capitol insurrection, as they were fleeing the House floor, and she was looking for Hakeem Jeffries, the most senior Democrat that was still on the Capitol complex. And the first thing she said to him was, we have to start impeachment. She knew full well that this was going to possibly imperil her career. She made the decision that she was going to always speak her own truth.
I've been clear in my views about President Trump and the extent to which following January 6th, I don't believe that he should be playing a role in the future of the party or the country.
On that high note?
McCarthy never attended another press conference with Cheney again. it would take another 6 weeks or so before they formally pushed her out of leadership. Another month or 6 weeks, the House voted to create this January 6th Select Committee. Pelosi gave one of her spots to Liz Cheney, and Liz Cheney accepted. She was essentially accepting a Democratic spot. And if she just sort of had stayed quiet, she might have been able to navigate this and win re-election, still be in leadership, and not have any real trouble at all. But at that point, Liz Cheney said no. She was going to go after Trump every chance she had. Liz Cheney, having lost her congressional primary here in Wyoming, now faces the next question of what to do with the rest of her career. There are some who really do want her to run for president. She's not naive. She knows that this era's Republican Party is probably, almost definitely, not going to nominate someone who is being so much of a critical force against the former president. But she believes that there needs to be a candidate who will take on Trump every single day.
Okay. All right. So that's basically a little summary about Liz Cheney. Okay, so let's just do a couple of make sure everybody grasps it. How was Liz Cheney able to get to the top of the Republican Party in such short amount of time? I think 3 years, maybe three or four years. How did she get to the top? There are a couple of ingredients.
Heredity.
Yeah, she. Good name. Yeah. Right. So number step one, be the daughter of Dick Cheney. Correct. Right. All right. What else? That alone is not going to get you a. That's.
I mean, she's smart. Right, okay. You can tell, like, she's very. Like an orator, like a very charismatic. Like
she has good speaking skills. They put her in the Bush administration. They put her as already a spokesperson in the State Department. So she already got into government while her dad was still part of George Bush's presidential team, and she got in a lower league. What did the Republican Party find appealing about her that allowed her to move up and then. And then ultimately become the congressperson from Wyoming. She did something very effective, which the video, I think, captured very nicely.
She kind of sold people on her, like, conservative bona fides, you know what I mean?
Bona fides. I mean, bonafides, I don't think she's not that. She is, has always been, a staunch Republican. But the key point is that she would get onto Fox News, and basically she was, you know, the tip of the spear.
She's a good, attack dog, kind of, you know what I mean?
Yeah, she was very effective of getting onto Fox News and basically attacking Barack Obama in every
elegant way. Like, she did it in a way where you wouldn't think that she's attacking him. You just think that she's criticizing him.
Right.
A little clip where she was like, well, to say that he's not, like, telling the true story, that would put it lightly. Like, she has etiquette. It's, like, really, like, nice to see in today's society.
Right. So she said, like, I don't think he's acquainted with the truth. Okay. Instead of saying he's a bold-faced liar. So therefore she is being a acerbic and aggressive spokesperson for the Republican Party. Naturally, she gets into Wyoming as the congressional person by virtue of the fact that, number one, she was a big she part of Team Trump 100%, and B, which is Wyoming, I voted for Trump. I think 75% of Wyoming citizens voted for. I mean, that's the red of the red, states. A. And she basically, her argument was, look, I'm a, I'm a, I'm a, um, you know, Washington insider, which she is. She spent most of her life in living, you know, with her parents in Washington. And that's one of the things they're attacking her now, that she's not really an authentically a person from Wyoming. And she got this, and she won, you know, a dramatic, strong victory. She became the congressperson. And then, which is more strong, and then she gets promoted to basically being in a very strong leadership position, because she is a talented woman who speaks well and is effective in putting forth the conservative case, you know, to the media. So that's, so she's like, you know, she's rocking it. So she gets the same level of position in regards to the leadership in like 3 years. Okay. So what event transformed Liz from a staunch Trump supporter to a person who is committed to make sure Trump is nowhere near the Oval Office? What was the event that changed, as the video portrayed very powerfully? Marvin?
Attack on the Capitol.
So what happened specifically? She's there.
She thought out at that moment, as she was seeing what was going on and seeing how wrong it was, that she sought out one of the colleagues, counterparts in the Democratic Party, to say, yes, we should go ahead with impeachment again.
Right. So the attack on the Capitol on January 6th was so
egregious.
So egregious, so shocking, that here is the person who is the number one Trump supporter basically turns around. And then whenever she gets in front of a mic, she's basically, she votes for impeachment. She is saying that. And then, of course, she agrees with the ultimate betrayal of her, you know, for party, when Nancy Pelosi wants to have a Republican and part of the January 6th thing. She takes a position, and not only she takes it, she's really the one of the main spokesperson. So obviously, it didn't take long for the, you know, for the Republican Party to pull all the plugs here. You know, she started to, and then of course, you know, Trump supports obviously a woman who's against her, who's a pro Trump person and advocating for the fact is that Donald Trump did in fact win the election and it was really a lie, whatever. And she gets nailed. Now, just by way of balance, or just to show the other side, what does the Republican Party view or think about Liz Cheney? What's the Republican Party or different divisions within the Republican Party think about Liz Cheney?
They call her a rhino.
What is it? So what does a rhino mean?
A rhino is a Republican in name only. They say that she wears the same team colors, but it doesn't actually play with the team.
Right. So she went in one day from being a one of Trump's strongest supporters and vocal spokespeople who are out there, with the credentials and the pedigree, as Scott pointed out, of a Cheney, you know, an old guard, and then she's turning on them. So therefore, what did that say? She's not really a Republican. Right. Now, there's the Republican Party. Is basically split. 70%, 65 to 70% of Republicans still are pro-Trump. 30% are not pro-Trump and support her position. Okay, so that's what's going on. So if you are in the Republican side that are supporting of we need to move on, then you're going to be in favor of Liz Cheney. If you are a pro-Trumper, you're gonna say for some way or another this was a personal motive. She wants to do it for her own power, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I'm not interested necessarily what is happening in the soul of Liz Cheney. This is not an eighth grade class. This is not a social studies class. I will leave that to Amanda to take that job as she does it every day at SAR. But this is by way of introduction to appreciate the Parsha. Okay. So in order to get into the Parsha, we got to get into one of the most important principles of being a Jew. So let's get into it. I'm going to do a share screen. Bear with me. Okay. All right. Marv, you want to start us off? Bavakasha, this is the Rambam, the fifth chapter of the Laws of Teshuvah. This Sunday, the Shabbos and Sunday is Rosh Chosh Elul. That means we start the 40 days, or if you're in MJ World, the 40 days challenge before we get to Yom Kippur. Okay, so here we go. Rambam Hilchot Teshuvah, chapter 5, Halacha 5. Marvin, you're on. Just need to unmute. All right. Let's you keep on working on that. We're going to call you back. Daniel Wall, can you read?
One second, Rabbi. Let me see. From the principle, this principle?
Yeah.
This principle, free will, is a fundamental concept and a pillar on which rests the totality of the Torah and mitzvot, as Deuteronomy 30:15 states, "Behold, I have set before you today life and good death and evil." Similarly, Deuteronomy 11:26 states, "Behold, I have set before you today the blessing and the curse," implying that the choice is in your hands. Any of the deeds of men which a person desires to do, he may, whether good or evil. Therefore, Deuteronomy 5:26 states, "If only their hearts would always remain this way." From this, we can infer that the Creator does not compel or decree that people should do either good or bad. Rather, everything is left to their own choice.
Okay, so here the Rambam brings down a principle which there is universal among every position in Judaism accepts. Not in necessarily every detail, but in the principle of free will, which basically means that man has a freedom to do either good or evil. Okay, we're going to get into that specifically. Okay, and this week's Parsha, which is Deuteronomy 11, "Before I've set before you today the blessing and the curse, it's up to you." Okay, now let's now make the application to Liz Cheney. What personal considerations would go into Cheney deciding whether or not to oppose Trump? What was going through her mind? This is a woman, everybody will agree, whether you call her a rhino or not, knows one thing about this woman. She is smart. And unless she's smart, she knows politics. Because she grew up in Washington, her father's Dick Cheney. There's nobody, and she's a congressperson. And she was, there's nobody who's more savvy. So what did she think about? What went through her mind about thinking about whether or not to oppose Trump?
Rabbi, I'd like to offer a possible answer.
Go ahead, Dan Levine.
I think that she's acquainted with the truth.
Okay, but before we get to...
That was a joke. That was a joke, because that's what she said. He's not acquainted with the truth.
Right. So... good, but going a step with that, what is she considering? She had to make what they call a cheshbon ha-nefesh, a calculation of the mind. What was she thinking about? Albeit it could have been very quickly.
I was really just thinking about making the joke, but now that we're in a real conversation.
All right, I appreciate the joke. Thank you, Dan.
You're welcome. Maybe this is not what your point you're getting at, but I feel like with politicians, it's a calculation of how to win the game of politics. It has nothing to do with the soul or what's good or bad or any of that. I don't know.
Right. Basically, the goal of a politician, at least the ones that we're acquainted with, is how do I get ahead? How do I get reelected? How do I move up in my position? So what kind of cheshbon was Liz Cheney, at least the way the narrative in, you know, the Washington Post narrative, I don't know what does it appear that she was considering? What was the conversation in her mind, as best that we can infer? We don't know, but what does it seem like?
I think that she actually did a calculation in her mind, and since the behavior was so egregious on January 6th, that she decided that she maybe wanted to be remembered a different way in history. We're not in her brain, but I think that it relates to this week's Parsha because it's the choice that she made, right? Like, she had a choice to go with everybody else or to take a stand and then pay the consequences.
Good. If she would have gone with everybody else, what would be the political benefit that she would reap?
She would fly under the radar. They would think that maybe she would be a good presidential candidate because of her father's history and because of her history. It would have been better for her politically to stay under the radar, given the reading of the country, and that was 60%. You said still support that the election was fake. So statistically, she would have done better if she just stayed under the radar.
Excellent. So number one is, on one side, is from political benefit, definitely, as the reporter pointed out, and Amanda is underscoring here, is that her move could be, don't say anything, be chill, no comment, don't comment about it. And wait till everything went down, and don't make a fuss. You're the congressperson from Wyoming. Mach Schnell, still, be quiet. And then she could have avoided all kind of problems. She would have then glided to another victory of being, she would have easily got the reelected for. Be a congressperson again for another term. And she could have then lived to see another day. What was their other consideration? And she speaks about this very, considerably. What's her other thought? So why didn't she do it?
I don't think she could have, she didn't want to leave that sort of legacy of she wouldn't be happy with herself.
Why not?
Because, she believed certain things that defined her character. And if she, sat down and, went quiet, it would have gone against her beliefs, what made her her.
Exactly. She believes that she's, as a Republican, as an American, that there are certain principles of governance. And by in her view, allowing President Trump to go without any consequence for what she believes he did, which was to rile up a crowd to go try to get Mike Pence to, overturn not to certify the election, and to not have him properly punished. And if it did, and even after the impeachment was not fully successful, then advocating that to promote that he should be barred. Or not gain elected office again as being the president of the United States. So she makes a claim, and the truth is, from expediency, she's arguing that basically her, being a good American and protecting the Constitution and protecting the fragile nature of our system requires standing up, even though she went from being on the top of the power structure to be knocked all the way down. To basically get the anger and people trying to, who paid tons of money to basically have her lose the election and have her knocked out. She knew basically, she knew she's going to do the thing. She's going to get knocked out. Get knocked out. And lo and behold, she was knocked out. She got her positions of power in the Republican Party gone. Her position as a congressperson thing lost. So that was her thing. So she had to weigh this out. Do I want to have my political power, or do I want to do what I think is correct? Okay. So this is a moral choice. Okay.
Rabbi, if I could just interject only because I've been around a number of politicians, and I've seen cases where politicians do have their own calculus. She may have had an initial calculus. First of all, I think she may have felt very personal about her space being invaded. She was also, you know, her father was part of the Bush administration, and the Bush family had really soured very heavily on Trump, particularly because he went against the Bush from Florida.
But even after Donald Trump made fun of Jeb Bush and knocked him out of the race, she was still a staunch supporter through his 4 years and seemingly up to January 6th.
Well, but she didn't really talk out against the initial impeachment. If she had been doing that, you know, I would be a little less skeptical if it was all just, you know, that she didn't have maybe some other motivation. She may have felt that the country was turning against Trump initially, and she felt invaded personally. So she may have thought that there'd be a good chance that she could rise up in the leadership position herself if she took them. Once she bought into it, she just really bought into it, and she was determined about it, even at the expense of her career. But that was, you know, that's a possibility. I'm just offering that as an
right. So you could argue that no, that her move is the counterintuitive move. I will pay the political debt now. I will lose my standing now, but ultimately I will win the day. In other words, you could argue it's all really politics. She's making a much more shrewder, counterintuitive move that right. She ultimately will come up on top by going against Trump. Now, that's not what she's saying, obviously. Now, again, that's what I said before. I do not know what's in her heart, nor does anybody else. But at least I want to use this to be an example of what Bechira is. The key thing is that this is not a simple decision, and there are a lot of conversations that are not, you know, videoed. What do you think people in the Republican Party, when she's starting to make, you know, even after January 6th, is saying that she has to be pro impeachment? Do you think that she was? Do you think there were some conversations had between her and the leadership? People calling up, you know, calling her, threatening her. Do you think that happened?
Yeah.
Okay. So, you know, being that she's basically doing an act of national betrayal. So she's under a tremendous amount of, and again, it's because she's not just a Trump supporter. She is possibly one of the most vocal and visible and prominent and distinguished, you know, part of the administration. So she's under a lot of pressure here. This is not an easy decision. Now, most people think, I'm going to give you a scenario. We're going to do a mid-class scenario. You walk into a restaurant. You sit down. The server gives you a menu. And you look at the options. The classic options. You got meat. You have chicken. You have fish. You have salad. You have pasta. Okay? And you're looking at all these options and you're thinking about what are you going to do? Is that an example of free will? Based upon what you read from the Rambam?
100%. And I think that because, like, you could choose to have something healthier, you could choose to have something not healthy. And it's if we truly believe that, like, our bodies are on loan to Hashem, not to get like sappy or anything, then we do have a choice what we put inside us.
Well, in other words, making a decision could be, but is, would you say whether or not you order meat or chicken is an example of good or evil?
No, I mean, it's all relative, right? Like, but
would you say, I've said before you, life, good, death, and evil? What type of decision is the Rambam from the Psukim saying is a free will decision is? And by extension, what is a free will decision not?
You want me to answer, or we can wait till other people go?
Good.
Okay, I think that what the Rambam is saying is it's about situations that test our moral character. It's not like if exactly. I use a pen or a pencil to sign something. It's something that's challenging.
Correct. Exactly right. Free will is when you are confronted with a choice of morality, good versus evil. Now, in general, when you go to a restaurant, you having meat, fish, salad, or pasta is not a good versus evil decision. It's not generally a moral decision. It could be maybe we can say, well, it's a non-kosher restaurant. Okay, but I'm just saying, by and large, it's not an active, it's not really the realm of free will. In fact, really, when you go to a restaurant, it really is what people say. What's the question when people, when they get the menu, they ask themselves, or they speak to others. What question do they ask themselves or others when you get a menu at a restaurant? What question are you asking yourself?
Should I wait to hear what the specials are before I make my decision?
That is one question. What mood am I in? What mood am I in? Am I in a steak mood? Am I in a chicken mood? Am I a fish mood? Am I going salad and pasta? What am I doing? What kind of mood? And whatever force of whatever emotion I have is going to rule the day. You know what I'm saying? So it's not, that's not really free will. That, in fact, is what would the Jews, at least the Rambam, would agree that really is determined based upon your background, your environment, the various cues, all the different forces that are largely not conscious to us. That's not really, because your decision is really automatic, really. You start to visualize the steak. You start to visualize the chicken, fish, and then you start to think, like, what do I have a greater attraction to? And then you might consider, well, what do I want to spend? Oh, I'm trying to be good on my budget. I'm trying to be good on my diet. You might have other calculate, but it's not really a decision of, as Amanda said, a morality. Not how the pasuk says, life and good, death and evil, blessings and curse, good or evil. What Liz Cheney is, she articulated, I don't, again, caveat, don't know if it's true, but she's saying that if I would just lay low and just go with the flow, I would be an evil person, allowing somebody who is not fit to be a leader in the United States to be a leader. So the way, and even though that she said, I'm going to lose all my power. And so far she has lost all her power. She's no longer have any position in the Republican Party. She's still, till she has to leave Washington till January, she'll be on the January 6th committee. She's still Congressperson, but then was it January 19th, she has to pack up her office and go home because she is done. Now, as Marvin pointed out, maybe she might see another day. So that really is a Bechira, really always the sign of a Bechira that it entails much pressure and heartache because you have two competing values, good versus evil, and you're struggling about what to do. If it's not a struggle, it's not really going to be a Bechira decision, okay? I want to, so here we're going to go. We're going to start breaking it down. What are three elements? What three elements does Cheney's choice have in common with every Bechira decision? There are three, at least three elements of every free will decision. What do you guys say?
Well, you could choose. You have to be able to choose either one.
Well, there's a step before that. Uh, I would argue perhaps the hardest part of Bechira.
I think that they're identifying that there's a choice to begin with and that it's a moral issue.
I would even step before that.
Maybe deciding that there's good and bad.
Even a step before that.
Can you give me a hint?
Even the decision to think about it. Most people, when they have sticky moral issues, one way of not avoiding the stickiness of the issue is to not think about it. In other words, don't even make it an object of thought. Just keep on going. Keep on going. Nothing to look at here. Just keep on pushing the cart through the aisle. Yeah? No looking. Just keep on going. Not thinking about it. So the decision to think about if this is a moral issue, what is the good and bad involved here? That's step number one. Step number two is to give a deep thought to what are the both sides, what are the consequences of each side. And obviously, if something is deemed evil, it's something which is going to be very, very attractive. We're going to get to some examples, and you'll see what I mean. So step one is the decision to think about the topic. Step two is to identify two sides, like Benjamin Franklin put both sides on two sides of the sheet, and the pros and the cons of doing either one. To do the Bechira L'Tov or the Bechira L'Ra, choosing the good or choosing the evil. And then step three is once you have a clear, deciding based upon your analysis to do the right thing. Those are the three features of a Bechira decision, okay? Even though you feel tremendously pressured that emotionally you want to do the opposite. We're going to get to, emotionally, I'm sure that there was a part of Liz would want to maintain her power, maintain being a congressperson, maintain her position within the Republican Party, get the accolades and love and attention of everybody and just keep on going. Nobody's saying anything. Why does she have to be the one? Just lay low and just racking all the keep the kavod coming. Keep the honor and glory coming. She did not do that. And then she's nothing but being vicious. If you go on to Fox News, she basically is attacked all day long. Okay. She was on Fox News for 6 years as a regular. You know what I mean? Attacking Barack Obama and also being a spokesperson for the Trump White House. Okay. And now she is by those very same people, she's being attacked. That is unpleasant. Not only that, if you go against the Republican Party, there are people that want to kill you. It's not only not popular, but it's now dangerous. Her whole campaign, they had to do everything quietly, and she walked around with now a security detail. So she did not want to do. I guarantee you, that is not fun. Okay, so she paid heavily. Question number eight: why is Bechira the pillar which rests the totality of the Torah and the life of mitzvot? Why is free will so critical?
Critical to what?
The Torah and Judaism. Why must you have free will? The Rambam says it's the pillar on which the totality of the Torah and life of mitzvot. Why is that true?
Well, there would be no point to it all. Okay. To the Torah, there was no free will.
Unpack that, please.
Well, the Torah is a system of commandments.
Yep.
And if we have no control over whether we are able to keep those commandments, then there would be no purpose to commanding us.
Correct. A commanding to act morally by doing the mitzvot and avoiding the prohibitions assumes that you're a moral actor. If you cannot act morally, then you can't do them. In other words, you can't do them. It would not be doing a mitzvah. You'd be doing a robotic doing of activities, but fundamentally, the Torah is speaking to a moral agent. You cannot act. You cannot make a moral decision. The Torah's got nothing to say to you. You can't have the mitzvot. There's no point to reward somebody for doing something that's not beyond their control, or punish them for doing things which are beyond their control. So the entire Torah would fall apart without free will. Free will is a cornerstone of the entire system of Judaism. Does everybody understand that point? That is, shall we say, the most important point of tonight. Okay. Everybody good about that? All right. Let's get to some practical. Let's read the Parsha. Okay. Daniel Wallach, you did a good job. Keep on reading if you can.
Okay. You can therefore see that I am placing before you both a blessing and a curse. The blessing will come if you obey the commandments of God, your Lord, which I am prescribing to you today. The curse will come if you do not obey the commandments of God, your Lord, and you go astray from the path that I am prescribing for you today, following other gods which you have not known.
Well done. So in addition to saying I'm putting before you a blessing and a curse, and if you obey the commandments, you're going to get blessing. And if you don't, you're going to get curse. Why does, question number 8, why does Hashem increase pressure on us by threatening punishment if we choose wrongly? Isn't the decision-making process of Bechira pressure enough? Conversely, why is he so generous in giving us a blessing for exercising our Bechira properly? Or Hashem is sweetening the package. If the Jewish people as a whole and a Jew individual chooses Judaism, they get blessings. Conversely, if they don't, they get curses. So why is that necessary? Isn't there enough pressure for Bechira? And why are you giving you a bracha if you choose Bechira properly, you choose properly, why do you get a blessing? Why is there this additional overlay of package?
I think because if you know right from wrong, then you should be held accountable. But if you don't know right from wrong, he's increasing the threat because he expects more because you know more. Like, do you get what I'm saying?
But if I know right from wrong, then I should just do what the right thing is, and I should avoid doing the
wrong thing. Doing the right thing is hard when other people aren't necessarily doing the right thing.
Yes, it is hard. It is. Correct. So one point is that it's an additional encouragement to do the right thing, to help a person through the free will process, because doing the right thing in the face of people doing the wrong thing is very, very hard. Now, that is certainly correct. But then we talk about what is blessing and what is curse. There's two ways of perceiving that. One is intrinsically. One is extrinsically. What is the difference? Let's say, for example, by Liz Cheney, the punishment, what will be the punishment for her being quiet? Let's assume that's the wrong decision. Let's say she didn't quite. What punishment would she really? What punishment would occur?
Well, perhaps in future generations, people will look back and say you were on the wrong side of history. That's from like looking to the future. But then also to think about I think she claims to be a pretty like religious, like Christian person. So they have like some standards that are similar to ours in this case. So she might be bringing religion into it as well.
But I don't want to be a person who's a sellout. I can't look at myself. The punishment is that I have to walk around knowing that I sold out the country for my own personal gain. And I'm an and I'm and I and I have the scarlet letter of being an immoral person, a dishonorable person. The blessing is that, okay, I don't have the power, but at least I can look at myself in the mirror like I did the right thing. So that's not an extraneous blessing or curse. That is something that flows naturally from the decision. So what the Torah is saying, that there are both a promise of intrinsic and extrinsic blessings. You do the right thing, good things will happen as a consequence of your decision, not necessarily immediately, but ultimately. And the hardship of it will be removed. Now I want to bring this out with three examples. We'll get down to the, because it's hard to, instead of talking about it abstractly, I want to talk about it practically. Scenario number one: Steve Mgier attends his friend's wedding. The smorgasbord is amazing. He has recently committed to a thoughtful eating program. He sees the meat carving station and has a strong desire to eat everything with no limits. How is this a Bechira moment? What will be the bracha and klala, the blessing and the curse that will emerge from his decision? And how would pre-planning his eating at the wedding figure into a success or failure? How is the Bechira decision?
He could say, like, I'm going to go to the roast beef guy, and I'm going to get like one slice.
Well, that will be that. No, but just before we get that, you're already moving what Steve should do. I'm asking, how is this a Bechira, a free will decision? How is Bechira fitting in, free will fitting into this? He walks into that gorgeous smorgasbord. He's just committing for his health and health as well being to eat in a certain program.
He's putting his long-term health over his short-term, you know, happiness.
Okay, so what's the moral? Where is there a moral decision here? Where it says, I give you a blessing and a curse, or as he says earlier, you know, how is the decision of good or evil?
Isn't it a mitzvah to go to a wedding and make others happy? So he decided to go to the wedding.
Well, that's good. Well, that so already he's doing. Steve is already doing a mitzvah, provided that he's going to be there to in fact, add joy to the bride and groom. Yes, but that's not. But beforehand, he's hitting up the old shmorg, okay, and he feels compelled to go to the meat carving station and eat everything with no limits. What's the moral decision here?
Well, there might not be enough for everybody else, which is highly unlikely because I just got married.
No. He's not going to eat. He's not taking up. We've all been to a Jewish wedding. I don't think you've been to a wedding where they have run out of food at the shmorg. Very rare indeed.
I'm joking. It's
right.
It's an OTD situation.
Again?
It's an OTD situation. Once he goes off the derech, he may stay off the derech, or he may find other opportunities more frequently to go off that healthy eating program that he had thoughtfully committed to.
Right. So if he wants to be, he's committed to his health. That's a value. I want to be a healthy person. The way that I'm going to be a healthy person is I have a certain particular program. And it's not saying not to eat anything, as Scott suggested, but not to indulge that desire to be involved in binge eating, to binge at the thing. So binging is, or being involved in gluttony, just stuffing his face till he can eat no more, which, you know, there's no better food typically at a wedding than at the shmorg. It's one of the best foods, where the best food is. Everybody here knows that already. That to not know that would be a rookie mistake. So, So the bottom line is, now, if he does just sit there and, you know, the guy cuts slices and he sits there and just eats and eats and eats, what will be the klala that he will experience? What will be the curse, or, you know, the negative consequence that he will experience?
He might get sick and then miss the huppah.
He'll get sick. I don't know, but he'll get sick, or he will eat till he is feels sick. He's not going to miss the chuppah. I don't think it's going to happen.
You won't be able to dance the horror.
Even okay, fine. He might be able to dance. The fact is that he's going to feel internally as a failure, completely feel that I can't control myself, and he's going to give up on the plan because he, you know, see, I can't do it. See? And then once he says, once I'm off the plan, forget about it. I might as well have double dinner and double dessert, whatever. Just go rolling for it. So that's now, or conversely, let's say he says, you know, something, I'm going to listen to, you know, I'm going to feel chizuk from Scott, and I'm going to have precisely one slice of the roast beef, which is within my plan. I'm going to enjoy it. And then I'm going to spend the time talking and drink a glass of one beverage, whatever, my friends, and enjoy the people, not only the food.
So there is an idea of a cheat day, which I hear works pretty well.
Okay, but he's just committed to the thoughtful eating program. Once, because the truth is, the klala could be once he's derailed, it's going to be very hard to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. He might feel demoralized. So therefore, pre-planning his eating would be good to ensure that he has success. Now,
Rabbi, a wise man once said to me, "Failing to plan
is planning to fail."
Planning to fail. I don't remember who it was.
One of my favorite lines. It's not even mine, but yes,
I've heard that too. It's a good one.
You may have heard that. Yes, failing. Failure to plan, a plan to fail. And
I heard it first from you, Rabbi. I don't
that's
know.
That's it. And then don't forget, Dan, plan your work and work your plan. Okay. All right. Now let's get to a little more juicy. Let's put up the fire a little bit juicier for the next Bechira situation. I would say an ultimate Bechira situation, which many MGers have found themselves in. Jane MGer just met a wonderful guy at work, Brandon. Brandon is wonderful in every way, and he's really into Jane. The only problem is that he's not Jewish. Brandon asked Jane if she would like to join. Brandon asked Jane if she would like to join his team at work. How is this a Bechira moment? Now, Brandon did not ask her out. Just said, join my work team. How is this a free will decision for Jane?
She knows she's going to put herself in close proximity to him. And if she has some sort of interest in him, he's a wonderful guy. Obviously, the temptations are going to be there. And she's going to get more and more familiar with him. And he'll get more and more familiar with her. And then if he does ask her out or something, that's a whole issue at the workplace. It could lead to greater difficulties down the road. So by keeping separation, as is typical in the Orthodox community, where men and women are a little more separate from each other, they don't necessarily shake hands and do some of the other things that they do. It is to keep a separation purposely so that you don't get yourself in trouble with temptation.
Marvin, outstanding. What Marvin's pointing out is that a sin, does not happen at the point of, you know, Brandon going out with, and Brandon and Jane are dating, and then he's asking her to marry her. That's not where the problem happens. The decision to ignite the relationship starts way earlier. In other words, when it comes to self-deception, every person's a genius. So Jane feels, well, why would I want to join Brandon's work team? Well, because he's cute and he's awesome and he also likes me a whole lot. And yeah. Even though it's all about the work, but it will soon, as Marvin pointed out, it will soon not just be about the work. It'll be about, let's talk about work over a drink. Let's talk about work over dinner. Let's have a Netflix and chill at my apartment. And then you got some sorrows going down. So the decision actually is when you're not in the much earlier state, will Jane, who feels she, I have to think about this, on one hand, I would really enjoy the romantic experience of being with Brandon. So that's the desirable part. And the other side is that I know that I will basically give up my values and I will betray the Jewish people by trying to engage or being willing to engage in a relationship with a non-Jew romantically, even though right now it's not romantic, but there's a part of a person inside that maybe will happen. So the bracha that will happen if she makes the decision not to do it would be that she remains resolute, even though it's very hard for a person to give up walking away from an attractive person of the other gender who is, you know, wonderful and amazing in every kind of way and walking away from that. That's extremely hard. You know what I'm saying? And maybe she doesn't want to be alone.
Speak for yourself, Rabbi.
Okay. I'm just saying my assessment of life itself. And, you know, so this is a big Bechira decision. Huge. And many MGers have struggled with this because it's, we live in a very mixed, you know, we do not live in a very separate isolationist, let's call it Hasidic lifestyle. Where, you know, the modern Orthodox Jewish community is very much in the community. Okay. Okay. Here we go. Scenario number three. Joe MGer is working hard in sales. Business has been slow. He meets a client who happens to be an existing client of his colleague. He pitches him a deal, and the client agrees to his terms. How is this a Bechira moment? What will be the bracha and klala, blessings and curses that emerge from his decision? What's going down here?
The blessing would be you get the commission on a new deal. The curse would be you just destroyed your relationship with your coworker.
Well, you stolen from him.
Right, you stolen from him. And like everybody else in, you know, your team knows, like...
Well, let's say you can get away with it. Not every time do you have a, you know, people can steal and get away for it for a time, for a short amount, or for a long time. It's not impossible. So Joe, on one hand, can feel the benefit, the tug of the benefit of making more money, of making an additional commission, right? Feels that great appeal. On the other hand, he says, "Well, then the negative is that I have to be a thief and I have to betray my friend." So the person's struggling with that, you know, and he's thinking about the pros and cons. And the decision to not do it is not simple. That's Bechira, as we mentioned before, always is hard and always has a lot of pressure. So to step away when you're having a financial difficult time, when you have a shortcut to some easy cash to solve an immediate problem, is a very challenging situation. Okay? Therefore, he has to stop, think about it, analyze it. What are the pros and the cons? Well, the cons, I get the quick cash. I take myself out of a difficult financial situation. The pro is that I'm, by stepping away, I'm doing the right thing. I'm not being a thief. And I'm not betraying my friend. And that's a difficult situation. That's the Bechira, real Bechira, which are moral decisions, which I gave you three examples tonight, are challenging. Liz Cheney, at least the way it's presented in the press, it was hard for her to step away from the position of power, theoretically, to do what she felt was good and moral. You know, so that's the example of Bechira. That's what our Parsha opens up with. Behold, I've set before you the blessing and the curse. And that really is a foundation of a Jewish life. We are confronted with moral choices. You know what I'm saying? In the workplace, socially, all over the time. And, you know, the Torah uses a lifestyle where it makes it, easier somewhat, but a true Bechira decision can be challenging. So, and that really is what Judaism is all about. Any questions? All right. So everyone, I want to wish everybody a good night. Lala Tov. And I'll stay time next week, everybody.
Tadarabah, Rabbi Penny Lila Tov. Bye, everybody.